It is Wednesday, December 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States remembers the late President George H.W. Bush.
He really was, in some respects, the last sort of imperial president, if you will. The presidency's changed since then very much.
We look at the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, and at-risk young adults learn the art of building wooden boats. It's all ahead. The United States is bidding farewell to former President George H.W. Bush. He's being remembered at a state funeral in Washington, attended by top American political figures, along with current and former leaders from around the world. Former U.S. Presidents Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama are joining the current commander-in-chief, Donald Trump, for Bush's funeral services at the Washington National Cathedral, where they will hear a eulogy from George W. Bush, the late president's son and the 43rd president. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Britain's Prince Charles, Jordan's King Abdullah, and Polish President Andrzej Duda are among those at the funeral to honor the 41st U.S. president, who died at the age of 94 last week, a quarter century after leaving office. Bill Whalen was a speechwriter for George H.W. Bush's 1992 presidential campaign, which the late president lost to Bill Clinton. Whalen is now a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University in California. He tells me how the media landscape changed during Bush's administration.
Cable television, satellite television, and the idea that presidents were no longer at the mercy of the big three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. They could actually go on to CNN or CNBC and make news if they wanted to. And Bill Clinton played this very well, and so did a guy named Ross Perot in 1992. They learned alternate avenues of media. The president was a little slow to this in 1992. In 1992, there was a thing called satellite tours, which meant that you would take your candidate. And in the case of President Bush, you'd sit him down in the room in the White House and you'd say, okay, Mr. President, over the next half an hour, you're going to talk to four markets around the country in California and Illinois and Texas and New York, let's say. That's a way of campaigning, just appearing on the local news there. This really wasn't prominent before that, and so that was a change. The other change, and this is to me a very interesting one, when Bush ran for office in 1988, that's the same year that Rush Limbaugh moved from Sacramento, California to New York City and WABC. And that really was the beginning of Rush Limbaugh, the big force of, you know, now conservative talk radio. 4 years later, in 1992, Rush Limbaugh was no longer really a mystery. Rush Limbaugh was a force in media. He had about 13 million listeners on his show every day, and the president understood this. During the primary in 1992, Limbaugh did not support Pat Buchanan, but he was telling his listeners, hey, listen to this guy. And that was a problem for the Bush campaign, and the fear of the Bush campaign in 1992 was that Limbaugh might, in the fall, he wouldn't support Bill Clinton. He didn't like Bill Clinton, but the fear was he might say, you know, send a message, vote for Ross Perot. So in June of 1992, President Bush invites Rush Limbaugh to stay at the Lincoln bedroom in the White House, a talk radio host being invited to the White House. Imagine this, and staying in the Lincoln bedroom. This is really the beginning of talk radio as we know it today, this very large, powerful force in American politics. So imagine the novelty in 1992 of a talk radio show host being invited to the White House as opposed to 2016, a talk radio host, Laura Ingraham, speaking at the Republican National Convention, or in 2018, Sean Hannity, also a talk radio host, actually campaigning with the President of the United States. So 92 is kind of the beginning of this era for conservative talk radio.
I was speaking to someone earlier, a historian, and he was saying that Bush followed Ronald Reagan in the White House, and Reagan had this reputation of the great communicator. Bush was not a natural in that regard. So, say, perhaps the interviews that he did, say, with the local media, maybe he wasn't, they didn't go as smoothly for him as that they might have for, say, a Reagan or later, you know, a Clinton.
George H.W. Bush was a lot of many great things, but he was not a natural orator, not along the lines of Ronald Reagan or even a Bill Clinton or a Barack Obama, very silver-tongued devil's day. President Bush was not much for big speeches. He was really not much for eloquence when it came to talking. He sort of spoke in choppy patterns, and this became a problem because the world does change during his watch. The Cold War comes down, and with that, voters shift their concerns, the United States, and they shift on the domestic concerns, and they want something different in the president. They want vision, and they want empathy. And these were two things that George H.W. Bush was not very good at talking about, that, as he called it, the vision thing. Bill Clinton derided him for calling it the vision thing, and it did sound clumsy coming out of the president. But in terms of empathy, the idea that a president got down on his knees and read to children in classrooms and hugged people and just empathetic things we're used to now with today's modern presidents, that was not something we were used to in 1992, and the presidency was much more aloof, much more distant, much more imperial. So that's one thing I think to reflect upon as we say goodbye to H.W. Bush. He really was, in some respects, the last sort of imperial president, if you will. The presidency's changed since then very much. Joe Biden is out today talking about how he has the best resume to be president. Well, one thing we've seen since George W. Bush left office is usually in the election, the guy with the better resume, he loses.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. We have shifted away. We're looking more for presidents who are better communicators, just more seemingly in touch. And the idea of, well, I have the better LinkedIn resume, that doesn't work with voters anymore. So that's a bit of how things have changed in this country as well. Bush is obviously the last one-term president. He's also the last president, by the way, who never had control of at least part of Congress during his presidency. Everybody who's come along has had either complete control or at least one chamber during their time in office, but not Bush.
Bill Whalen, former speechwriter for George H.W. Bush's 1992 presidential campaign. He's now a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University in California. Tom DeFrank is a veteran White House correspondent and a contributing editor to the National Journal. He tells me about his first meeting with George H.W. Bush.
I first met George H.W. Bush in Thanksgiving of 1974. It's a long story, but basically I was traveling with President Ford in Asia. And after Ford met with President Leonid Brezhnev in Vladivostok, he sent Kissinger to Beijing to start arranging a visit by Ford to Beijing in 1975. And so I was, my boss said, you should go with Kissinger. So I was thrilled. And when the Kissinger traveling party got to Beijing, the U.S. rep for the People's Republic of China, George Bush, had a reception at his residence. And that's where I met him for the first time. He walked into the middle of a angry snit by Secretary of State Kissinger, who had just accused me mistakenly of writing fiction. And as Kissinger stormed away, the U.S. rep to the People's Republic of China said to me, now what the hell was that all about? Hi, I'm George Bush. And so that's how we met 44 years ago. And over the years, the fact that I think that I'm from Texas, I went to school at Texas A&M, where everybody now knows his library is, and a lot of other shared experiences and cultural ties. He and I did a lot of business for a lot of years for a very long time, and I will always be grateful to his personal and professional generosities with me.
Yeah, I bet he never forgot you, partly because of that. But that's a good story. What are some of your other favorite recollections of the late President Bush?
He, as we say in Texas, he was the real deal. And I'm not talking about his political life or his ideological views. He was just a good human being. I remember once Secretary of State Jim Baker once said to me, the day I was going over to have an interview with Bush for the first time, he says, now be ready for this. You'll go in the room, and before you sit down, he'll say, is this chair going to be comfortable for you? Is the sun going to be in your eyes? Do you need to go to the bathroom? Do you need a drink of water? He will be solicitous to a fault about you, and he said it's one of the best things about him. And I found that to be absolutely the case, and I found it time and time and time and time again. I remember once my wife and I had just been engaged, and this was right before the White House press party of 1989, and we go through the receiving line, and he asked my fiance if she's a Washingtonian, and she said, no, but I will be soon, sir, and showed him her engagement ring, and Bush kind of shut down the receiving line for about 30 seconds just to talk to her and show the ring to Barbara Bush, and a week later we got invited out of the blue to a Bush movie screening in the White House Theater. So that was the kind of thing that I remember, large and small gestures, the master of the small gesture, a guy who had every right to feel himself special and patrician and elite, but never behaved like that. He was much like President Gerald Ford, an ordinary guy in the good sense of the word ordinary. And again, the personal and professional kindnesses are what will endure with me for a long time.
You know, one of the things I think was interesting about him, even though he was born in Boston, grew up in Connecticut, was educated in Massachusetts and in Connecticut, but early in his work life, he moved to Texas, and even though he lived a number of places, of course, here in Washington, D.C. and around the world because of his job, he very much was a Texan, and he will be buried there in Texas, and that's a state where you're from. So he always had a strong tie, though, to
right.
Texas.
At the Bush Library once, he said to me, he said, if Barbara goes first, I'm selling the house in Houston and moving here. Of course, which he didn't do, but that's what he said to me. And I said, and what does Mrs. Bush think about that? And he said, poorly. And so, but he's done the next best thing. He's going to be buried there with his beloved wife and his beloved three-year-old daughter, Robin. On the grounds of the Bush Library in College Station, Texas. He liked the whole frontier experience and the frontier mentality and sociology. I think it was also a psychological decision on President Bush's part. He wanted to be his own man. He didn't want to just live a life of patrician, elite comfort. He wanted to get out there and do something on his own. And that's why he did it. And he had a very strong connection, as you say, with Texas. I mean, he once said to me, I admire the values of Texas. And I don't mean the values they teach in classes. I mean the values of the place and the frontier spirit. And I think that was, I mean, it seemed a little incongruous for people with his patrician background. But I think it's a credit to him wanting to do something different and be a different person than the person he grew up with.
Veteran White House correspondent Tom DeFrank. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Donald Trump tries to calm global markets after stocks drop sharply in response to the U.S.-China trade war. The Islamic State clings to its last stronghold in eastern Syria. The U.S. restores a permanent diplomatic presence in Somalia, and Amnesty International says the United Nations should investigate the 1988 Iran mass executions. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Archaeologists conducting a dig at an ancient Italian cemetery have found the skeletal remains of a 10-year-old child that suggested a so-called vampire burial. The remains included a skull with a rock intentionally placed into the mouth in what was described as a possible religious or superstitious effort to prevent the deceased from rising from the dead. According to the researchers, the cemetery where the remains were found was used to bury babies and young children back in the 5th century. It's thought that the youngsters may have died in an outbreak of malaria that swept the Italian region of Umbria at that time. The archaeologists say that they believe placing the stone into the child's mouth may have been part of a funeral ritual designed to contain the disease as well as the body itself. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about a program in Virginia that helps at-risk youth to improve their lives. U.S. U.S. Marine Lieutenant General Kenneth McKenzie, nominated to head Central Command, told lawmakers Tuesday losses among Afghan security forces are unsustainable. He also told the Senate Armed Services Committee he doubts they can defend their country without a continued American military presence in Afghanistan.
I think one of the most important things that we can help the Afghans with is continuing to refine their force generation process, how they recruit, how they train, and how they present forces for actual execution. As you noted, their losses have been very high. They're fighting hard, but their losses are not going to be sustainable unless we correct this problem. If we left precipitously right now, I do not believe they would be able to successfully defend their country. I think it's a conditions-based approach. We're going to go through this winter. We'll see how they do in the force generation phase of this winter. But I don't know how long it's going to take. I think that one of the things that would actually provide the most damaging to them would be if we put a timeline on it. And we said we're going out at a certain point in time. As we've seen when we precipitously withdrew from Iraq earlier, certain effects probably follow from that.
Nearly 15,000 U.S. troops are deployed in Afghanistan. The exact number of Afghan security force deaths is not known, but the New York Times in September reported on average nearly 60 are killed each day. At the same time, Pakistan has sought to assure visiting U.S. Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad it would back a negotiated settlement with the Taliban insurgency. Khalilzad has indicated he hopes to reach a settlement by next April. In a letter to Prime Minister Imran Khan, President Donald Trump offered to renew their strained relationship in exchange for Pakistan's help to end the 17-year war. Nazif Shahrani is an anthropology professor in Central Asian and Middle East cultures at Indiana University who has been in Kabul the past several months. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Afghans fear recent American statements and actions are viewed as helping the Taliban.
I think the Afghans are worried about the fact that an American government are essentially engaging in a psychological war of sorts in support of the Taliban, making them very strong, and that there is no military solution and we can't do much about it. And this is maybe their intent in essentially giving Afghanistan to the Taliban through this so-called negotiation or negotiated political settlement. This is very worrisome in Kabul. Why is America telling the world and the Afghans that they have no chance of defending their own country and that the armed forces are not capable of doing it and so forth? Afghans themselves actually have plenty of confidence on their own forces, despite, you know, problems, weaknesses and so forth. But there seems to be a sort of sense of nationalistic confidence that the military could do it, and if they were backed up properly and if they were, you know, supported instead of essentially being torn down, that they are not capable and Taliban are strong and so forth. So this is really a psychological war of sorts from the Kabul point of view against the people of Afghanistan and their desire for the right kind of peace settlement and not one where everything is handed down to Taliban by the U.S. government. That's the fear that prevails in Kabul.
President Trump this week sent a letter to Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan, making clear that Islamabad's assistance is fundamental to the health of the two countries' strained relationship. Can Pakistan help resolve the Afghan conflict?
Pakistanis have always turned Afghanistan and Taliban as their instrument of a proxy war with India. They could do things because they're sponsoring the Taliban force and political community on their soil, but they have not done much of anything. They have failed their test of supporting properly the peace efforts or resolution of the conflict. They continue to be supporting the Taliban. So I'm not sure whether these latest assurances from Imran Khan is going to be any better than the previous one. The assumption is that Imran Khan has the army in his pocket. I don't think that's true. It's the army who has Imran Khan in their pocket.
Nazif Shahrani, anthropology professor at Indiana University. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. The art of building small wooden boats is being used to help young, at-risk adults turn their lives around. At a seaport center in Alexandria, they're serving as apprentices in a boat-building program that gives them the skills, confidence, and discipline to change their lives for the better. VOA's Deborah Block takes us there.
Apprentice Chris Atkins is learning what it takes to build a small wooden boat.
It's been fun to learn how to use these tools.
Here at the Seaport Center on the banks of the Potomac River in Alexandria, Virginia, the small group of apprentices from 18 to 22 years old learn how to build sailboats and canoes.
Learned definitely measured twice and cut once.
Besides carpentry and mathematical skills, the 19-year-old from Florida is also learning more about himself.
This opportunity really has given me the opportunity to really dig deeper into myself and find what I want to do.
At the helm of the program is Jimmy Gottfried, who had also been an apprentice.
Many of the apprentices in our program have faced many challenges in their life, such as lack of family support, dropping out of school, having run-ins with the law, and they're looking for a way to gain back the confidence they need to go back out into the workforce.
So that you can.
The year-long program pays a small stipend. The apprentices are guided by volunteer mentors, like Fred Geiger, who teach them how to build the boats and improve their lives.
When you work with wood, you feel it, it becomes part of you. And as their self-confidence gets better, then you can start to address some other things in their lives, like are you paying your bills, are you living?
Atkins had to drop out of high school to work.
My mom died when I was 8 years old, so that's always something that's on me. And if I haven't had the support from my father, the one reason that I came to the program was because they want to help you. And I guess what is hard for me is because I'm not used to someone wanting to help me or enthusiastic about it, or if anything would believe in me.
We'll find out. You'll get
apprentice program manager Jay Helinski is a role model for the group. He completed the program about a year ago.
And they know that I'm, you know, living proof of what hard work, dedication, and just the willpower to succeed gets you to.
When the boats are finished, they are sold at a raffle. Atkins says he will be sad to see them go, but knows, like life, they are meant to sail onward.
It's all the creativity that goes into making them. I'm glad that they're going out and they're going to a good home.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.